Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why some four-year colleges and universities are getting into the dual enrollment space.
And a U of A researcher documents a surprising and violent civil war between chimpanzees in Uganda.
But first, the Trump administration is waiving environmental laws and spending billions on building a wall on the southern border. But in Texas, much of the border is marked by the Rio Grande River, and there they are putting in buoys, big orange tube-like buoys designed to stop people from crossing the river. But our first guest this morning reports the planned hundreds of miles of buoys could have major consequences. Martha Piskowski is a climate reporter based in El Paso, Texas, for Inside Climate News, and I spoke with her more about it.
The buoys that are being placed in the Rio Grande are these massive orange cylinders. They're about 12 feet long and they're connected one to another. So there's no gap between them. So it's supposed to create a continuous barrier across the river that would stop anyone from getting over it.
Okay, so that's kind of how they would stop migrants from crossing the river, which has been something that's happened on the Rio Grande for a long time, right?
Right. The idea behind the buoys is that if you have a barrier in the river itself, people don't even have the opportunity to get over to the other side and get on land.
Yeah. It sounds like the Department of Homeland Security went around environmental laws, waived contracting laws, expedited this process in lots of ways that we've kind of seen happen in various parts of the border, especially, you know, as we're seeing wall construction happen here in Arizona as well. What did DHS do here to get this buoy project underway?
This project really picked up momentum last year once there was funding for these contracts. And the first section is going in the river near Brownsville, Texas. So there was a series of waivers last year that kind of cleared the way. And then these contracts started going out for hundreds of millions of dollars, some of them over $1 billion. I added up around $2 billion in contracts that reference the buoys.
Wow.
So this first section in Brownsville, but then also contracts that have been issued for other parts of the river where they'll presumably go next.
Okay. So you're reporting here, Martha, on the possible environmental impacts of these buoys. If they end up being as extensive as the plan is, which is very extensive, what could those environmental impacts look like?
Right. The Rio Grande through South Texas and the Rio Grande Valley, you know, it's a dynamic river. So over the last few years, it's been quite low because of the drought. But there are floods on the river. There have been hurricanes that have come up from the Gulf. So one of the big concerns is just in a storm, how are these buoys going to perform? Customs and Border Protection says they're designed for a 100-year flood, but we haven't been able to see any specific technical information. And then just having these buoys in the river could really change the flow of the river. It could push the water in different directions, cause sediment to build up in new areas. So something like this has really never been done on this scale. And there's a lot of questions about what impacts it'll have on the river.
Yeah. You talked to this geomorphologist, which is a great title to begin with, who is kind of studying the existing spherical buoys that are already on the river. What did she have to say? This was about flooding in particular.
Right. So this is Adriana Martinez. She studied these buoys that are in Eagle Pass, Texas, which the Texas government installed a couple of years back. And this is a very small section of buoys compared to what the federal government is doing. But she did observe that, you know, when the water was low, the buoys would actually be sitting on the riverbed and then, you know, sand and sediment would build up around them and the water was being pushed in different directions. She had concerns that it could change the Mexican side of the river. So this was only a 2,000-foot section of buoys that she observed these changes on, while the federal government is now planning to install hundreds of miles of buoys.
What would the full scale of this look like? How many hundreds of miles are we talking about here?
What the Customs and Border Protection has proposed so far is 536 miles of buoys. The first section they're doing is 17 miles in the Brownsville area. So, if they build this whole chain of buoys, it would go all the way up towards the Amistad Reservoir in South Texas, a significant chunk of the border between Texas and Mexico.
And Martha, this is all happening as we're watching the border really change. Like, unauthorized border crossings have dropped dramatically in recent years. How does that kind of context play into the, I guess, the necessity for a project like this?
At the moment, we're just seeing really low numbers of people attempting to cross the border. I live in El Paso. Anyone who lives on the border sees these ebbs and flows, both in the number of people arriving and then the media attention that follows. But right now, month to month, there's very few people attempting to cross the border or being apprehended. But that hasn't slowed down the Trump administration's border wall or border buoy plans. To the contrary, they're really moving quickly and implementing these projects, in Texas, Arizona, a lot of different parts of the border. The waivers specifically for Homeland Security to issue those waivers, there is meant to be a Homeland Security justification for, waiving all of these federal laws. So a lot of people are asking, what's the urgency to do this when we're seeing such low numbers of people trying to cross the border?
And you report that this project has really been going under the radar in a lot of ways. What's the reaction been like there in southern Texas, though?
I was reporting in Brownsville earlier this year, and that's where the first buoys are going in. And some local activists had a rally and have been going to county commissioner's court, is what's called in Texas. And a few counties have passed resolutions in opposition to the buoys and trying to raise this issue, with their congresspeople or, just get some more information from the federal government. A lot of people just don't know that this is happening. So, in the Rio Grande Valley and South Texas, people are trying to spread the word, before the buoys extend to more areas of the river.
All right. Martha Piskowski, a climate reporter based in El Paso, Texas, for Inside Climate News. Martha, thanks so much for your reporting here. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
More and more Arizona high school students are taking part in dual enrollment programs. Maricopa Community Colleges says it had nearly 28,000 dual enrollment students during the 2024-25 school year. By way of full disclosure, KJZZ is licensed to the Maricopa Community College District. Helios Education Foundation is reporting an increase in participation across the state as well. Dual enrollment generally allows high school students to take college classes and earn college credit. And in some places, it's becoming so popular that four-year colleges and universities are starting to offer the program. Scott Carlson with the Chronicle of Higher Education has written about this. He joins me. And Scott, for those who aren't familiar with the concept of dual enrollment, what exactly is it?
Dual enrollment is this construction that has sort of popped up across the country in different forms, in different states. But it's basically a situation where students in high school can step away from high school courses and take college courses for credit, either in their high school or at the college campus. It's different in different settings. It's not always called dual enrollment. Sometimes it's called college and high school. Sometimes it's called concurrent enrollment. But that's basically the structure. And it was founded for a couple of different reasons. One is to give students some sort of sense of what college is going to be like. The other goal of dual enrollment at some level is to offer these courses at a reduced rate or a lower cost. Sometimes they're free. And so the student is able to knock down college credits while still in high school at this lower price point, and that gives them a head start in their college journey.
And typically, as you report, high schools have worked with community colleges and other sort of non-4-year colleges and universities to, to offer these classes, but that seems like it's changing.
Well, it was sort of conceived as a community college project. I mean, dual enrollment is where the community colleges have been able to support their enrollments by bringing these students in, but with that sort of promise that the community college is an open access kind of institution and it allows the students to experiment and it's typically lower cost. You're in courses with students that are also sort of trying out college in their own way. So the community college was sort of the natural place where dual enrollment would grow up or become a thing. But what you find now is a lot of four-year institutions that are entering the dual enrollment space where they're able to and compete for those students. Because, of course, in this environment in America right now with colleges, so many colleges are seeking students to create a pipeline for tuition, which they need to stay afloat.
Are there particular fields of study that you're seeing four-year colleges and universities trying to enter in the dual enrollment space?
Not in particular. I mean, I think one of the things that colleges are trying to do is go at the prerequisites that students would be taking in those first couple of years at college. There are instances where high schools are playing into kind of a CTE or a career and technical education environment or that kind of programming. That's all about helping students who come from lower income backgrounds get into high demand fields, areas where we really need workers, cybersecurity, nursing, and so on.
What kind of impact is it having on community colleges that four-year institutions are starting to get into this?
Well, I mean, for community colleges, this is a major source of enrollment and has been really since the pandemic and maybe even before. There's some community colleges where 50% of the enrollment is dual enrollment. They've been able to float the boat on high school students. So for community colleges, this is extremely important, a very important pipeline of students that they would end up recruiting over time in a lot of cases, not in all cases, but in a lot of cases. So naturally, the four-year institutions are going to look at that and say, why can't we capture that market ourselves? Why can't we go for that? In some cases, they're barred from that, or there are barriers to them. For example, in Colorado, what is called dual enrollment is called concurrent enrollment there, and it's really reserved for the community colleges. If you're going to do dual enrollment at a four-year institution, you have to pay for it as a student or as a family. So there are barriers there for the four-year institutions, but they're trying to work around that to get access to that pipeline of students.
I mean, is there enough of a pool of students for both community colleges and four-year colleges to really have successful, thriving, robust dual enrollment programs?
Not in some parts of the country, no. In some parts of the country, in the Northeast, in the upper Midwest, for example, you're seeing this demographic decline. So the numbers of students that are coming out of high school are going to be dropping over the next couple of decades. So that's a shrinking pool of traditional students that these four-year and two-year institutions would be going for. And now they have to seek out other sorts of populations. High school populations, going for the students that are before college is one of those areas that they're trying to exploit. The other area that a lot of colleges are looking for is the adult population. So students who went to college, knocked down some credits, but never finished. What's the possibility of there of bringing those students back in and allowing them to finish?
One of the things that's so interesting about this happening now is that in Arizona, very recently, the state allowed community colleges to offer four-year degrees. So, like, on the one hand, you have community colleges starting to do what four-year colleges traditionally had done. And then you also now have four-year colleges starting to do what community colleges had traditionally done.
Yes. I mean, to some extent, this is mission creep, right? It's the institutions trying to find these other avenues to get students. It's also to some extent a function of the institutions trying to play to their mission and trying to help out the local economy. So the four-year programs that are popping up at community colleges, often that's popping up because they are in areas of desperate need for workers. So nursing and cybersecurity, these other sort of direct to job kinds of programs. And the thirst, the hunger for those kinds of workers is just so high that the four-year institutions just can't serve the capacity. So more of the state policymakers and state higher education boards are turning to the two-year institutions as an option for that. Again, though, like, I mean, there are wars between institutions or different types of institutions at some sort of subtle level, in the sense that this does, again, though, play to what these institutions need, which is bodies for tuition, which help to support the college itself.
Well, so how do you see this all playing out?
Well, I mean, I see this continuing to be an area of competition. The fact that the states and the state higher education boards need to sort of figure out the rules around this is important for the students themselves and the consumer protection that the students need, because transfer is always one of the big issues when it comes to coming out of or transferring out of community college, right? And you don't want to complicate that process even more by making this college and high school process not clear, not set up, not with a robust set of rules around how it's going to work for the student.
Do you get the sense that policymakers are aware of some of these issues that they need to start to think about?
So I think policymakers do feel that they need to deal with this, but there are so many intense interests on the part of the institutions, which are powerful lobbying organizations. So how do you meet this out among all of these different institutions? It ends up being a headache for a lot of these policymakers in different states, but it's an issue that they're going to have to hammer out.
All right. That is Scott Carlson with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Scott, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what a civil war among chimpanzees can teach us about our own humanity.
But first, the valley was once the destination for those with damaged lungs in search of clean, dry air. In the early 1900s, white tents to house tuberculosis patients popped up around Scottsdale and Sunnyslope. For many years, families would move asthmatic kids to Phoenix.
These days, though, we're better known for dirty air and high rates of valley fever. But you might not know that Arizona's hot, dusty landscape makes it a hotspot for another chronic lung infection. Non-tuberculosis mycobacterial pulmonary disease, often called NTM. Not many physicians know how to diagnose it or where it comes from. Researchers at the Centers for Disease Control have called it a substantial public health concern.
Infection rates around the world are increasing as the population ages and the climate changes. It's estimated that close to 300,000 people in the United States and thousands in Arizona have NTM lung disease. Longtime Valley journalist Terry Green Sterling is one of them. She was first diagnosed almost a decade ago. She still has it. For the uninitiated, her daily routine may sound a little over the top, but for her and others with NTM, it's become a way of life. This project, called Breathless, was supported by the Pulitzer Center.
I haven't had a hot, steamy shower in years. When I'm drawing a bath, I'm sure to turn on the fan and open a window. It's just one of the many precautions I take to prevent additional exposure to a bacteria that can eat holes in my lungs. Arizona is teeming with non-tuberculous mycobacteria, or NTM. It can make its way into the air from soil and water. It can be deadly. People over 65 or those with weakened immune systems or lung damage are vulnerable to the infection, and it's especially prevalent in warm climates. My exposure to NTM can change from day to day, inside and outside. I try to be discreet with the measures I take to avoid breathing in more of this bacteria or a different, more destructive one. It's become a normal part of my routine, but I'm sure my behavior can seem bizarre. When I wash dishes, I hold my breath to avoid breathing in steam. I boil my drinking water. I dodge misters in restaurant patios. I wear a mask while gardening. I blast air purifiers in my bedroom, writing room, and kitchen. I clean out my lungs every day with a nebulizer, and I'm meticulous about sanitizing my breathing equipment. Other than using the nebulizer, none of these precautions have been recommended by my doctors, but they make me feel like I'm doing something to protect myself.
Mycobacterium are mycobacterium that live basically are environmental pathogens. So they live in the soil, they live in like the water supply. They can proliferate in our pipes, proliferate in our shower heads, dust storms. I mean, there are so many different ways that people can be exposed.
That's Dr. Alex Perry, an infectious disease doctor in Tucson. He's a clinical associate professor at the University of Arizona College of Medicine.
I don't think if you garden, you're not trying to give yourself a lung infection, but it's just like this. These are, unfortunately ubiquitous, which is really frustrating for people because they're like, what could I have done differently? And I'm like, not interact with the environment ever. And that's no way to live.
NTM lung disease has long been ignored by most medical and pharmaceutical professionals. For 9 years, I've interviewed the few scientists, doctors, researchers, and health policy advocates who do focus on it. When he began this work, Perry quickly recognized a significant gap in patient care.
There was this whole population of people that were kind of, to a certain extent, suffering, but more importantly, like had this diagnosis, but didn't really know what it meant, and really didn't have anybody to really talk to.
One thing that makes me feel better is a breathing technique called autogenic drainage. It's a way to clean my lungs without machines, and I use an app on my phone as a guide.
Short breath in. Hold. Two. Three.
But some at-home practices,
Short
according
breath
to
in.
Dr. Perry, are dangerous.
Some people want to, if they use nebulizing, they want to use different chemicals to nebulize. Like some people want to use like cleansers, bleach, hydrogen peroxide. I'm like, please don't do that. There's no such thing as a safe form of that in your lungs.
Nontuberculous mycobacteria aren't just one species of bacteria. Some are more aggressive than others. Here's Dr. Charles Daly. He's chief of the Division of Mycobacterial and Respiratory Infections at National Jewish Health in Denver. He's also my doctor.
There are actually about 200 species now that are found ubiquitously throughout the environment in water and soil, and they can produce a chronic progressive lung disease in some people. Why that happens, we don't know. Why some people get it and others don't. But once someone gets it, it can be very hard to treat. The treatment outcomes are suboptimal, and it's one reason we're focusing a lot these days on drug development.
It's important to know what species you have. That will dictate your treatment. The species in my lungs is a member of the Mycobacterium avium complex, or MAC. It has grown slowly, so I have managed to avoid the usual treatment of three strong antibiotics over the course of a year or more. Not only is NTM lung disease difficult to treat, it's often hard to track. Dr. Daly has no clue how or where or when I got infected.
We don't know how long it could have been in someone's body by the time they present. They think, oh, it's from that hot tub, last week up in the mountains, but it might have been actually 5 years earlier somewhere else.
My symptoms showed up 12 years ago as an occasional cough. I started having frequent sinus and chest infections. I would often collapse on the couch and fall asleep as soon as I got home from work. After 3 years of this, a Phoenix pulmonologist diagnosed me with NTM lung disease. It's not contagious, yet it has a social stigma. It can be a messy and embarrassing disease. Some who have it feel judged for being exhausted, for coughing, for going to extremes to avoid further exposure. NTM lung disease often shows up in people who have bronchiectasis. Not to be confused with bronchitis, bronchiectasis means the airways are damaged, can't clean themselves, and are vulnerable to infections. Sometimes, even after years of antibiotics, the NTM infection doesn't go away, or a new species takes its place.
They go back to the same environment and then they get infected again. The recurrence rate for MAC pulmonary disease has been about anywhere from 25 to about 50%.
Lynn Hebert-Remsen lives in Scottsdale. We met in an online group for people with damaged lungs. We occasionally get together for coffee or talk on the phone just to check in on each other. Remsen used to be infected by NTM. She took multiple antibiotics for 17 months before the bacteria was gone.
They made me sick. The treatment was almost as bad as the disease. Gastrointestinal upset, nausea. I was never sure, you know, when I would be free, when I would be symptom free, and when I would have to find the nearest bathroom.
These possible side effects are why I'm trying to avoid taking antibiotics for as long as I can. Remsen was taking antibiotics every other day. If she were to have a recurrence, she might have to take them every day.
I just can't even imagine that. Every other day was hard enough, and I began to kind of plan my activities around the days that I would and would not be taking the antibiotics.
Remsen has been NTM-free for a decade, and she takes extraordinary precautions to prevent a recurrence. In addition to the precautions that I take, she sets her hot water heater to a scalding 140 degrees. She takes extra oxygen on airplanes. She wears a mask when she's outside on high pollution days.
I've actually had people stop me in the store and say, "Why are you still wearing a mask?" And the answer is because I still need to. And that's all there is to it.
To me, all of this sounds perfectly normal, even though it's not. But new medicines are being developed. There's hope. Recently, I received the news that I've been dreading. My NTM infection may have gotten worse. I might have to take those antibiotics after all and deal with the possible side effects. And if that happens, I'm ready. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Terry Green Sterling.
Breathless was supported by the Pulitzer Center with audio production by Amber Victoria Singer. You can read a more detailed version of Terry Green Sterling's story in both English and Spanish at breathless.kjzz.org.
Good morning. It is The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. There is increasing concern about the health impacts of being exposed to the class of chemicals known as PFAS. And a new study finds exposure by pregnant women to the so-called forever chemicals increase the chances of their babies being born prematurely and with low birth weights. It also increased the risk of infant mortality. The data come from New Hampshire, and one of the researchers says the study tried to isolate the effects of PFAS by themselves. Derek Lemoyne and Ashley Langer are among the authors of the study. They're both economics professors at the University of Arizona and co-directors of the Consortium for Environmentally Resilient Business. They join me to talk about what they found. And Derek, let me start with you and how you went about doing this research, because as you've written, you clearly cannot intentionally expose humans to PFAS, but you found a place where you could really measure the health effects of people who had exposure versus those who did not. How did that come to be?
So if you want to think about what do PFAS do to human health, you might imagine taking people into a lab and giving them PFAS. But as you said, we're not going to do that. We wouldn't and we couldn't for all kinds of reasons. So we want to find an experiment, what we call a natural experiment. So in messy real world data is something that looks like an experiment where some people were exposed to PFAS, some weren't. Ideally, they don't really know who they are. They basically went about their lives the same as each other, except that some were drinking water that plausibly had more PFAS in it and some didn't. The trick was that we found a setting in New Hampshire where there were mothers living near contaminated sites, and we were able to get data on where their wells were, the wells that were serving them were, and some of their wells were upstream in downwater terms, in groundwater terms from the contaminated sites, and some were downstream, and that was the variation we used.
And Ashley, it sounds like, just reading your findings, that the findings were pretty dramatic in terms of the health impacts on newborns based on whether or not their mother lived upstream or downstream from these contaminated wells.
Yes, we were very surprised at how substantial the effects were, how big they were. You know, we thought that there might be an effect on infant health, but we were fairly astounded by the fact that infant mortality was three times higher almost for the mothers who were receiving water from wells downstream of these contamination sites relative to very similar mothers at a similar distance from the contamination site, but who were receiving water from wells upstream. These were shocking to us.
Ashley, obviously, you know, real world data can be a little bit, I think, as Derek described it, messier than lab data. But is it possible, or how much of these numbers, how much of these findings do you think is attributable to PFAS versus any of the other variables that these mothers could have been affected by?
So we've done a lot of checks and robustness and, you know, really dug into these because we really wanted to make sure what we were getting at was PFAS and not something else. So these mothers, you know, they were controlling for things like whether there are differences in wealth or education or maternal health, smoking behavior, things like that. We don't see any difference between the mothers who are receiving water upgradient from these sites relative to downgradient in those types of demographic outcomes. We don't see differences in education, in any of these types of things, home values. So we are fairly convinced this is coming from where they're getting their water from. Now, we are looking particularly at contamination sites that had these older types of PFAS that are now generally not used. There's some chance there are other types of PFAS that are released at the same time that could be in drinking water, but we ruled out a lot of other potential avenues by which these results could occur.
So, Derek, one of the things your paper looked at is the cost, the economics of this. And I want to ask you about that because cleaning up PFAS is, of course, expensive. There's been a lot of talk about that around the country and here in Arizona. But you found the health costs of not cleaning up the chemicals are higher than the costs of actually cleaning them up?
Yeah, thank you for bringing this point up. So as economists, we bring two things to the studies. So one is a focus on like really nailing this the causal effect of PFAS in the data. And the other is once we've got an effect on health, we really want to monetize that to be able to, because that's the benefit of cleaning up PFAS is avoiding these negative health outcomes for mothers and infants. And then in addition to any other negative health outcomes PFAS might cause. And so we want to be able to compare that to the cost and ask whether policies to clean up PFAS make sense. And any regulator such as the EPA right now that's thinking about cleaning up PFAS would do the same calculation. So we use outside estimates of the cost of being extremely, for instance, low birth weight. So that imposes cost on babies throughout the rest of their lives in terms of higher healthcare costs, greater risk of mortality in the first year. It imposes cost in terms of lower wages later in life. And we use outside estimates of those. You know, this is all on average, obviously. And we use outside estimates of those costs. We can then extrapolate from our estimates in New Hampshire to the rest of the country. How many extra births of each type do we think there are? We can take our cost per type of birth and combine them. And then we can get the total extra burden due to PFAS. It's a coarse estimate, but it's a back of the envelope calculation based on something that we believe in pretty well for New Hampshire. The number we get is at least $8 billion. The idea is that it's probably, it's almost surely greater than that one because we know we should add different kinds of costs. We just don't know how to add, whether everything in one category is also in another category or to what degree they overlap. But it's at least $8 billion a year. And the estimated cost of cleaning PFAS up are under $4 billion, or complying with the recent EPA rule to clean PFAS up are under $4 billion a year. So that makes it look like a pretty good deal to bring PFAS toward that rule if that rule will be sufficient to avoid a lot of these negative outcomes that we're finding for mothers and babies.
Ashley, when you look at those numbers, you know, roughly $8 billion in costs health related, about $4 billion, a little less than $4 billion to clean. What comes to mind to you in that calculation?
So we think that this $8 billion number is really conservative as the potential benefits of removing PFAS from drinking water in these places where it's contaminating the drinking water. That's just for these outcomes for infant health. And so that doesn't address any of the other health outcomes that could happen. We're not looking at long-run cancers or any adult impacts that other studies have suggested might be there. As economists, we generally think about weighing costs and benefits. And here, if the costs of removing the PFAS are only $4 billion and the costs of leaving it in are at least $8 billion, this looks like a really good deal and a really good way to help infants over their entire lives.
Derek, I'm curious how you would hope that this data would be used outside of the sites that you were looking at in New Hampshire, given sort of what we know and what we don't know about PFAS and where it is and how much exposure people might have to it.
Yeah, there's a few ways that we would like to see some of these numbers used. So one is, as Ashley was saying, like there's a burden from any new rule to clean up PFAS, and that burden is going to fall on water utilities and therefore on their customers. There's also a health burden from having PFAS in the water that falls on their customers. And so one implication is that this is our study can inform ways of weighing those burdens. Are the costs customers pay, are they worth the benefits they're going to receive? Another is that the kinds of PFAS we're studying are what are called long chain PFAS that really haven't been produced much in the U.S. or at all in the U.S. since about 2010, but they're all throughout the soils. And so they're basically more or less nationwide. The soils contain a large mass of these, and they're slowly migrating down to our groundwater. So these are going to be entering groundwater over the next decades and centuries. Not only are there implications for utilities cleaning up, but these kinds of PFAS can be cleaned up fairly effectively by the types of carbon filters that a lot of people have in their homes and pitchers or in their refrigerators. So there is also the idea that you could, if we know that certain populations are especially vulnerable, and in our case, we're looking at a population of pregnant mothers that we show is fairly vulnerable to PFAS, then you could also just have much better testing and information than we currently have about who is exposed to PFAS and allow households to then take the actions at the household level to clean up some PFAS. So information itself might be a fairly cheap policy that could actually go a long way.
Derek Lemoyne and Ashley Langer are economics professors at the University of Arizona and co-directors of the Consortium for Environmentally Resilient Business. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. You might have heard a fascinating bit of news in recent weeks. Researchers at the Ngogo Chimpanzee Project in Uganda published a paper documenting a deadly split among a large group of chimpanzees. For 8 years, the chimps have been embroiled in what's being called a bitter civil war that has resulted in 24 killings, including 17 infants. It's an incredibly rare turn of events in chimpanzee behavior, and the story has been published all over the world. Our next guest this morning watched it happen with dismay. Jacob Negre is a primatologist and assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona, as well as co-director of the Ngogo Chimpanzee Project. He told me their ongoing conflict says a lot about humanity, even if not everyone has wanted to hear it. I spoke with him more about it recently, beginning with his reaction to all of the attention the story has gotten.
I am just overwhelmed by the range of reactions to this story. Some who see so much from their own lives and their own political experiences playing out in this chimpanzee mirror world, and other folks who are so deeply offended by any comparison between what we're observing in the chimpanzees and in humans. This story has in certain venues been described as a quote civil war unquote between chimpanzees, and that term as applied to these chimpanzees has really ignited diverse responses.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, are you surprised by that? It sounds like you were struck by it, but did it surprise you?
I was struck by some interactions I had in my department, actually, where other anthropologists were just so displeased that this was being described as a civil war between chimpanzees. I think for some folks, a civil war must involve nation states. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, I understand. But I do believe that our story about the chimpanzees has a lot to tell us about shared social mechanisms for fissions in societies, for splits, that perhaps, although we like to think that we are so exceptional and so special as humans, that perhaps some of our own social experiences are reflected in the lives of these animals to a pretty extraordinary extent.
Yeah. Oh, so it's fascinating. Okay. We'll get to that in a moment. But let me back up for a minute, Jacob, and just ask you about what you saw happen with these chimps in Uganda. I mean, obviously, this is a well-observed, you know, group of chimpanzees there as part of this project. But it sounds like this was almost a decade ago more that you started to see these kinds of divisions, this polarization within these clusters, as you call them, of chimpanzees. What did it look like?
Yeah, so I have been working at this field site in Gogo for about 13 years now. So when I started working at Ngogo, it was very clear that we were still looking at one group, what we call community of chimpanzees, that they would come together to eat and to socialize. And then one summer in 2015, we began to notice that the chimps weren't all coming together. We had chimpanzees in what we call the Western subgroup no longer joining together with chimpanzees in our so-called central cluster. And it was quite obvious to us. We noticed this, that, yeah, we had two distinct clusters. We thought that this was just an indication that conditions at Ngogo, ecological conditions, were so good, to put it another way, that there was so much food at Ngogo that right. these chimps didn't have to come together. So, yeah, none of us could have predicted in 2015 how this would play out.
Right.
We were all genuinely shocked.
Right. So, I mean, talk about how this played out and watching it. Like, these are chimps that I think it sounds like you all as researchers there know kind of intimately, like they have names. You watch them. You're aware of them. They're aware of you. Right. But you started to see like real violence happen, even to some infants.
Absolutely. So we began to see when these two different clusters of chimps would come together, they acted more and more as if they were encountering a stranger group of chimpanzees. Chimpanzees are quite fearful of strangers. If we were talking about humans, we might call them xenophobic. When they meet, there's a lot of fighting, there's a lot of screaming, there's a lot of running around. And as we've known for decades, there is lethal violence between chimpanzee groups.
Right.
And when we began to see this happening between different members of the Ngogo community, that's when we began to grow really quite concerned. And I do use the word concern quite genuinely. We are scientists, but we are also deeply invested in these animals. We spend a lot of time to protect them as well. And so to see the relationships at Ngogo deteriorating into increasingly violent interactions was genuinely disheartening to us. And of course, to then see that ultimately in 2018 rise to the level of lethal violence was, although we had seen this on the horizon for a few months at this point, it was still shocking that it finally happened.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned at the beginning some of the reaction that you've gotten to this and some of the skepticism, like this, you know, sort of pushback that we are as human beings closely related to or should learn something from what's happening in chimpanzee communities. Mm. But you as authors here describe these results as maybe a challenge to this idea that when humans go to war, right, including go to civil war, it's got to be something that's driven by these kind of cultural markers like religion, countries going to war. Do you think that this says something about humanity?
I may be biased in this regard. I've been watching these extraordinary animals for quite a long time now. every time we as humans try to draw a line in the sand between our species and say, okay, humans do this and other living things do this, you know, this is the thing that makes us human, inevitably we have to walk those claims back the more we learn about other living things. And I personally think this is one of those cases that although chimpanzees might not have religions, they might not have political ideologies, I do think that their social relationships have a great deal to tell us about our own. These animals live for a very long time. We think that some of our chimpanzees have lived into their 70s. And so the depth of their relationships across time is quite striking. And so to see these chimpanzees be able to treat other chimpanzees that they have known for decades as enemies is truly striking. It's difficult to overemphasize from a scientific perspective everything we know about chimpanzees, just how unusual it is to see them turn on their long-term friends, for lack of a better word. And so I think this story tells us a lot about the importance of maintaining social relationships for, you know, the good of society at large, that perhaps we like to think that our conflicts boil down to these big ideas like religion and political ideologies. But when it comes right down to it, I think it begins with how we interact with people and whether we interact with them affiliatively. Are we occupying shared spaces? You know, are we coming together to perform basic human social functions? I think there is a lot to this, how we relate to each other on, you know, a personal level and how that may scale up to the societal level.
Super interesting. All right, we'll leave it there. Jacob Negre is a primatologist, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona, as well as co-director of the NGOGO Chimpanzee Project in Uganda, joining us. Jacob, thank you so much for coming on. This is fascinating.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lauren.
A lot to ponder there with those chimpanzees. Huh?
Absolutely.
Wow.
There are like Netflix series about these chimps. It's wild. You gotta go check it out.
So interesting. All right. That'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thanks as always for being along. Remember to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.